Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrives in America. The reception so far ain't so pretty. This is Direct Impact. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. You know, it's funny. There's not one single person in the United States, except for maybe the president of the United States, who has as much access to U.S. politicians as does the prime minister of Israel. Think about this for a minute, all right? Stay with me here. The leader of Israel, unlike any other American or any other world leader, can simply pick up the phone and say, I'm coming to the United States and I want to give a speech to Congress. And you know what the response is from Congress, from our elected officials, from our leaders, from our government? Yes, sir. But of course, sir. It's nuts. Israel, look, is a great partner for the United States. I totally get it and agree. And what they've achieved in business and in technology is incredible. And on my visits there, I have found the people to be smart, fun, extremely honest. But what Israel's government, specifically its prime minister, is doing right now by massacring reportedly more than 100,000 civilians, including children, is a bridge too far, too cruel, which is why his visit is causing protests even before he gets here and gives his speech.
I'm a Jewish American. My grandparents survived the Holocaust. And growing up, I was always told that we should never let anything like the Holocaust happen again. That's why I'm here today protesting the genocide of the Palestinian people and calling on our government to enact an arms embargo on Israel and send no more weapons to the Israeli military.
We're here to say we don't want our tax dollars funding genocide. We are willing to put our bodies on the line to say that our Jewish values and our values as people mean that we cannot be funding this.
That's crazy, isn't it? Those are powerful words. By the way, the fact that our politicians get both bought and rolled by Israelis' politicians, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for us, you know, as Americans. I mean, if you're living in the U.S., you may not know it, you may not feel it, but let me show you how the rest of the world sees this situation where the United States provides a hero's welcome for a guy that the United Nations and the International Criminal Court has declared is a war criminal responsible for a deliberate mass genocide. I wanted to show you that because that's the way it's being covered in India, of all places, while you will never see coverage like that in the United States. Now, here's what's weird about all of this. Netanyahu's visit is happening at the same time the Democrats are rolling out their new presidential candidate. Remember, he was officially invited here by the Republicans, not the Democrats. So what are the Dems now doing? They're hiding, literally hiding Kamala Harris. You see, just like Mr. Trump's numbers shot up after his assassination attempt, when he was getting a whole lot of attention, obviously, Harris's numbers have been shooting up in the last couple of days as well because she has been getting all the attention. So now with Mr. Biden out of the race, the polls have shot up and it's pretty close to being a tie right now. And, you know, here's what the numbers look like. I mean, this is pretty darn close, wouldn't you say? 46 to 45. Suddenly, Mr. Trump is up by one, where he used to be up by four, five, six. Now, the corporate media, I should tell you, is making a big deal out of this poll. It came out in the last 24 hours. But let me give you some advice. I've been covering U.S. politics now for the better part of the last 30 years. And I can tell you that these polls, that you're seeing right there in the midst of this transition, this is not a big deal, okay? Polls are not about one or two reads in a moment of time. The way we always should look at polls is wait at least a couple of weeks to be able to recognize what the actual pattern, what the trend is. That's what polls represent, not picking one out and saying, aha, look who's winning, right? However, it is interesting to see how right now Harris's handlers are keeping Kamala Harris away from the Netanyahu visit as much as they can, because they know that young and ethnic voters can't stand Netanyahu. These are the same voters who don't like Biden, by the way, and are still not sure about Harris. The last thing Democratic Party officials need is to let those voters find out just how tight Harris is with AIPAC, the Israeli lobbying group who buys politicians like most people buy cheap toilet paper. As for Harris's family relationships, this is interesting. Her husband is Jewish, and he is pro-Israel. But guess what? Her stepdaughter, Ella Emhoff, is a model, reportedly doesn't identify as Jewish, and has even been known to express pro-Palestinian sentiments. She could be troublesome, even embarrassing, like Ronald Reagan's daughter, Patty Davis. Remember that? Maybe you don't, but she was. Sounds like her handlers are still trying to sort this one out. Like, what are we going to do with the stepdaughter, right? In the end, this whole idea of hiding a potential U.S. president from the media and the public while a foreign head of state is in town seems horribly dishonest and just distasteful. But for some bizarre reason, Republicans are not pointing that out. Why, right? They're instead continuing to talk about Joe Biden. Here's Tom Cotton. He goes on CNN to complain about how Joe Biden stepped down. I mean, I can't help but wonder, why in the world is he still talking about Biden when he should be talking about Harris?
Just last weekend, you had Nancy Pelosi, Barack Obama, George Clooney, Hollywood moguls, Wall Street bankers, all working behind closed doors to bring unbearable pressure to bear on Joe Biden.
You know, it just seems to me the attack on Biden seems wrongheaded, almost petty, given that he's an old guy. He's frail. He's out of the race, by the way, in case you haven't noticed, Mr. Cotton. Even worse for Cotton is the fact that his party is winning. Trump and Vance are still ahead in almost all the polls. And this America First message that they're putting out there is extremely popular with most Americans and certainly with almost all conservatives. Why distract from that? Anyway, there is one lawmaker who is willing to do the unexpected. In an extremely courageous speech in front of his colleagues, most of which are bought off, by the way, by the Israeli government and their money, this one senator is sharing his truth about Netanyahu and declaring that he will boycott the Netanyahu speech.
Mr. Netanyahu's war has been carried out with our warplanes, our tanks, our guns, our bombs, missiles, and bullets. It has been carried out in a manner shockingly inconsistent with the principle of proportionality. I will not be attending Prime Minister Netanyahu's address tomorrow. While I welcome a constructive discussion on how to end this conflict and achieve lasting peace and security for Israelis and Palestinians, I'm not interested in participating in a political stunt.
By the way, you can be guaranteed that AIPAC will now try to destroy Senator Peter Welch of Vermont by smearing him. They will now call him an anti-Semite for saying that, even though he's not. And then they will donate tens of thousands, maybe as much as $100,000, to replace him with another candidate of their choosing who says what essentially they want to hear. By the way, while Welch is pushing for peace, the U.S. State Department is pushing for more war in a bizarre, bizarre reaction to a peace gesture by China, where it's attempting to hold talks to try and end the fighting in the Middle East. Spokesperson Matthew Miller, this guy's a piece of work, you got to see this, actually expressed anger at China for even daring to talk to the organization that Israel says it's at war with.
We have not yet reviewed the text of the so-called Beijing Declaration. Of course, we will do that. But as we have made clear for months, Hamas is a terrorist organization, something that we obviously made clear before October 7th. But when it comes to governance of Gaza at the end of the conflict, there can't be a role for a terrorist organization.
I mean, just think of how tortured the logic in what he just said is. Israel claims it is at war with Hamas, which has about, what, 5,000 to 10,000 people in it, even though they've killed 180,000 people. Hamas has said on many occasions, by the way, and look this up, don't take my word for it, on many occasions that it is willing to release the hostages and sit down for talks. That's Hamas, the bad guys, right? But Matt Miller says that they can't have any conversations with them because they're a terrorist organization. So what is he saying? There's no way then to end the fighting. This thing could go on for another 100 years then, right? As long as you just say they're terrorists and we can't talk to them, we're just going to kill them. Kill as many people who may be associated with them. What? The State Department doesn't want peace in Gaza. They didn't want peace in Iraq when it was offered to them. They certainly aren't against any type of peace for Ukraine. And you know where else the State Department and its military contractor friends and their corporate friends don't want peace? Venezuela. Yeah, sorry, that's a fact. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Anya Parampil, who has written a book about that very topic. Anya's a journalist. She's an author. She's covered Venezuela. She's really smart, and I can't wait to talk to her. So stay right there. We're going to be right back. Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Joining me now, and I've been looking forward to this, is Anya Parampil. She's recently come out with a new book. It's called Corporate Coup. Gosh, great alliteration, great title. I couldn't think of a better title. A look at the attempted overthrow of the elected government of Venezuela, an intervention which was conducted by the United States. Now, this is interesting because maybe it's not one that's gotten as much attention worldwide. Worldwide as perhaps it should, right? I got to tell you, anybody out there, Anya, who has followed our State Department's actions, I mean, there was a coup in Ukraine in 2014. That's the reason the Ukrainian government's there. That's the reason the Russians are angry about it. There was a coup that put the Shah of Iran in Iran, which is why Iran is a disaster to this day. Not really, but that's why we've had problems with Iran, because of that coup back in whenever it was. Coup in Guatemala that ended up killing 200,000 people. This is a State Department of the United States of America going into places and basically fomenting coups because they don't like the government and they've decided they're going to change it. The government may be good, may be bad, but what the hell are you doing trying to change somebody else's government? And that's the question the world asks. Most of us Americans, or most Americans, unfortunately, they don't know about this stuff. But I got to tell you, your topic is fascinating. The coup that we apparently tried during the Trump administration in Venezuela was almost, in my opinion, laughably, horribly carried out. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. And it could easily, as you've said, be a comedy script. It could also be a thriller, a drama, because there are so many compelling characters. But this corporate coup that was conducted against Venezuela in 2019 was unprecedented, as I say in the book, because it was the first time that the U.S. government, while they're known for overthrowing other governments, particularly in Latin America, this was the first time that the U.S. actually declared mission accomplished before the regime change had taken place. They just got out and put the cart in front of the horse and said, we recognize this shadow government in Venezuela, when actually nothing had changed on the ground. And Trump, under the leadership of poor advisors, such as John Bolton in particular, who really drove this, and that analysis is based on all of the Trump-era biographies or memoirs that I read, John Bolton's memoir, Mike Pompeo's memoir, Mark Esper, the defense secretary. They all talk about trying to convince Trump to make this policy change, and that they thought that if they just announced this government, that that would cause the actual government in Venezuela to fall. And of course, it didn't. And here we are 5 years later. And the only accomplishment of this coup was really to loot millions of dollars worth of Venezuela's international assets. And in that regard, they succeeded.
It's so bizarre, because listen to what you just said. And I hope people around the world are listening to this and getting it. One day, Washington decided that they would proclaim a new president of a country. What? You just can't do that. You can't just give a speech at the State Department like Pompeo and Bolton and others did and say, we now have decided the new president of country X, forget Venezuela, any country, the new president of country X is so-and-so. What the hell made them think they could get away with that?
I suppose it was imperial hubris, and that's really the downfall of any empire, is once it becomes too big for its own, for its britches. And in this case, what you said is exactly true. The rest of the world recognized the precedent that this policy set, and that's why the vast majority of the world's countries did not recognize the U.S.-imposed shadow government in Venezuela. Other than 50 countries that are basically all of the U.S. allies, North Atlantic treaty allies in Europe, and then close Latin American countries that are under U.S. domination through military bases and various agreements, those are the countries that recognized this make-believe fantasy government. And the rest of the world, including the major powers in the world, Russia, China, India, Turkey, Iran, these are countries that are going to be very powerful moving forward. South Africa, countries that have heavy industry and they're rising economies. And these countries said, look, if it's Venezuela today, it can be any single one of us tomorrow. And I know for a fact that is what they thought, because those are what the diplomats that I spoke to while covering this coup said to me.
I'll never forget, and one of the reasons I've got this smile on my face is, as I was listening to you talk, I'll never forget, I was on the air covering this story, and there was a news conference at the White House, and Pompeo came out, and he said that he had a very important announcement about Venezuela, and he said, we are here to announce that we are now recognizing the new leader of Venezuela, and he called him Guido. Oh my God! Is this like a comedy show? I mean, what the hell am I watching here? He actually called him Guido. I don't know if that's in your book, but if not, it probably should be, because right then and there, you knew it's a bunch of drunks in a room somewhere or idiots who said, "Yeah, here's the plan. We'll get a new president in there, and what's his name? Oh, I don't know. Who cares? I won't even learn his name." Like, he didn't even know the guy, Anya.
No, he didn't. And Trump himself was not impressed with Guido, was only initially didn't even want to release the recognition of Guido under his name, but was only convinced to do so by Mike Pence, who had a phone call with Juan Guaido the night before this policy went into action, and convinced Trump that he was worth endorsing. But according to reports that came out just months later, Trump was walking around the White House calling Guaido the Beto O'Rourke of Venezuela and correctly recognizing that all of the good-looking military men, those were Trump's words, not mine, according to John Bolton, were standing behind Maduro. And yeah, here we are. It's 2024, and Venezuela in the coming days will actually hold presidential elections. Maduro will likely win, but it's worth noting that the main candidate running against him, Edmundo Gonzalez, was actually a functionary working in the Venezuelan embassy in El Salvador during the 1980s. Oof. At a time when the U.S. was running a dirty war on El Salvador and the region, actually, in Nicaragua as well. And he was someone who, because Venezuela was tightly allied with the U.S. and participating in that policy at the time, was involved with those crimes, alongside Elliot Abrams, the man who actually was appointed Venezuela envoy under Trump's administration.
A criminal.
Exactly, an actual convicted criminal.
Convicted criminal. Yeah, this is the guy who we chose to run Venezuela's policy. This is nuts. It's interesting, though, that you're saying, I'm fascinated by the way that you're explaining Trump. Like Trump basically was busy with other stuff, so he let these guys do this whole Venezuela thing. And then once they had announced it and were into it, he went to them and said, what the hell are you guys doing? It sounds like he was not happy with this Venezuelan coup or whatever the hell these guys are trying to do down there.
No, according to mainstream reporting, including in the Washington Post, that wasn't the case. But one tidbit that I share in the book is that you may recall there was that real embarrassing moment when Guaido actually tried to have a military uprising and failed miserably, was left in the street with a phone pressed against his ear, looking afraid, probably on the phone with Mike Pompeo or Bolton. And that night, I went on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News, and his show was very assertive against intervention, intervention in Venezuela at that time.
Good.
And it went pretty viral. And Tucker actually told me following that clip that Trump called him after that show and told him that he knew that he shouldn't listen to John Bolton, that if he did, he would be in World Wars 3, 4, and 5, that he basically kept him around to be tough, but that on this Venezuela issue, it became clear that Bolton was wrong. And this is not only based on my reporting that I share there, but like I say, the Washington Post said that after that moment, Trump was extremely disappointed in his advisors there. But I'm worried, Rick, because something I know you'll understand well is that very similar to the Israel lobby, actually, the Cuba-Venezuela expat lobby is very strong in the United States. So even if our leaders might have the right understanding of the policy and might recognize that our regime change policy is doomed in Venezuela, there is still this influence that I worry about coming out of Florida that is hard to stand up to.
Yeah, and you know, that's a shame because the Venezuelan community in South Florida and the Venezuelan people in general are just some of the most wonderful, most industrious, smartest, their abilities, their achievements. The country has a great history. And rather than finding a solution that doesn't involve calling everybody who doesn't agree with you a communist, the U.S. plays into that. Like we constantly go around the world and we foment these arguments, these disagreements, these so-called revolutions, as we call them. And the people who we're using don't even know they're being used by us because we just want to get their money or their oil. And it just seems like Venezuela is the perfect example of that. All my Venezuelan friends, I hear them say things and I go, oh my God, I wish you knew the truth. Like they're, oh yeah, yeah, we love the State Department. Yeah, yeah, go invade, kill this guy, kill that guy, start a war, kill my relatives, who cares, whatever. It's like, no, they're not. The State Department, these things the State Department does, they're not doing them for you, they're doing it for them. Ugh, do you get my drift?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you 100%. And Venezuela is a very good case because it has the largest oil and untapped gold deposits in the world. And the blueprint that I lay out, the tactics that they use in terms of propaganda, economic war, and hybrid regime change war, it's a playbook that they use against other countries, whether it's Iran, Russia, China. And ultimately, it's failing. And so that's my message to Americans is that we need to have a common sense foreign policy. If Cubans and Venezuelans want to participate in that, they have to accept that they are coming from the perspective as Americans. We should be approaching the country with our interests, not overturning a government so that they can go back and be powerful in their home country. That is not my job as an American citizen to back that project. If you're here in the United States, you should be looking at Venezuela and Cuba or any of these countries with, well, how can we just come to a mutual understanding and mutually beneficial agreement? Because that's the only foreign policy that is going to succeed in the future.
But the best thing about, I think, your book is even in the title, the word corporate, because that's the differentiator. If it was the American people who had said, we really want to do this in Venezuela because it's really important and, you know, we got to get this guy out and put this guy in. No. It's not being done by the American people. It's not being done for the Venezuelan people. It's being done by corporations who want that oil that's in Venezuela and all those other deposits that exist there. And as soon as we figure that out, the better we'll all be, including Venezuela and the United States. So I rest with that. Thank you, Anya. You are a delight to talk to. I can't wait to pick up your book. It sounds like a good read.
Thanks for having me, Rick. It's nice to see everyone.
See ya. All right. That's our show. Remember always to look outside your own box. Truths, you know, they seem easy sometimes. Oh, yeah, truths don't live in boxes. Look deeper. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.